Today's reading is Yes, I Want to Live in a Welfare State by Paul Stephen Dodendoff. And although these are someone else's words, they very much echo my own feelings, so I speak them gladly. Each section of the reading will end with a refrain, and if you feel inspired by these words, you are welcome to join in on that refrain, which will be, "Then yes, I want to live in a welfare state." For years now, my conservative friends asked me, "Do you really want to live in a welfare state?" And I've thought about it, and I decided, yes, I do want that. I would like to live in a welfare state. If we define welfare in the original meaning of the word, the condition of being well or getting along well, to fare well, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that my well-being and the well-being of everyone else includes that we all have healthy food, clean water, clean air, proper housing, an affordable, if not totally free, education, and full access to complete health care throughout our lives, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that we take care of the earth and the destructive practices that are poisoning the planet we are blessed to share, and we end the destructive practices that are poisoning the planet, and we begin to implement policies and practices that support and sustain our lives and the lives of generations to come, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that people and not corporations and not corporate profits are the primary concerns of our politicians and our national and international policies, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that the rights of all people to live in safety are protected by sensible laws that protect the children against violence and those who would place personal freedom over the good of all people, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that all people, regardless of their color, spiritual or ethical beliefs, gender, sexual orientation, or political views, are afforded the same rights and privileges as everyone else, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that all people without exception are given the right to vote without fear of harm, reprisal, or discrimination, and that money plays no part in whether a person can run for and hold office, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that our justice system does not favor corporations or one part of society over any other, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that our prison system is one that is not run by for-profit corporations, that its purpose is not retributive or punitive, but restorative, and one that sees the humanity in all people, difficult as that may be at times, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means having an economic system that is not exploitative of workers and does not perpetuate an oppressive class system, one that ensures that all people have the dignity of work and a fair and livable wage, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that our system of taxation is fair, progressive, and free of loopholes that favor the wealthy and corporations over all others, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. If welfare means that each of us care for the other, that the least among you is cared for and loved as much as everyone else, that racism, sexism, ageism, and all negative and harmful isms become a thing of the past, that we all support each other in living our lives to their fullest potential, and that we are all faring well, then yes, I want to live in a welfare state. In fact, I want to live in a welfare world.
I don't think I need to give a sermon after that. I don't know how many of you know about the Poor People's Campaign. It's a national grassroots organization. It was first conceived by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference back in 1968. calling for economic and human rights for poor Americans of all backgrounds. It was in its early days when MLK was assassinated, and for many reasons, the campaign did not reach full momentum. Then, in 2017, Reverends William Barber and Liz Thea Harris resurrected the Poor People's Campaign with a national call for moral revival. This revival has a wide platform, arguing that racism, poverty, over-militarization, and environmental degradation have moral implications that underline the foundations of this country, which threaten the health and spiritual well-being of all of us. They've written a declaration of their platform that begins with some quotes. So I thought I would read these. The first one is from the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Goodbye. And it reads, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or prosperity without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law." The Talmud, the book of Isaiah, says this, "Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. What will you do on the day of reckoning when disaster comes from afar? To whom will you run for help? Where will you leave your riches?" The way we use our money and our resources reflects our values and our ethical grounding. It is not a coincidence that the Poor People's Campaign is led by religious leaders, because it is the work of faith community to constantly be calling all of us to assess the morality of the decisions and actions of our country and of ourselves. Decisions that too often neglect our foundational values when life gets in the way, right? When we get scared by the economic fluctuations or distracted by our own personal needs or desires. It is hard to remember that the true work of religious community is to hold our moral ground and work for common good, even when it doesn't feel safe or convenient or logical. There is a reason that the prophets of the Jewish tradition were killed or reviled. We don't like to be reminded that we could act in questionable ways, and most of us respond with guilt or anger when our ethics or decisions are challenged. And yet, I want to point out, we also honor those people who call us out to be our better selves. After all, remember, the prophets of the Talmud are still remembered and quoted. Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, even thousands of years after they lived, we know their words. We continue to have prophets in our midst, those that carry on the tradition of calling attention when we stray from our principles and values. Some of them work at the national level, and some of them are sitting on the chairs in this space, in this room. And we have many dilemmas before us, confronting us on a regular basis. Today I'm going to focus on housing and homelessness, because this is a national problem and something we are addressing right here on this campus. I'm going to start with the big picture. Right now in the United States, there are 10 million people without housing or on the brink of homelessness, while at the same time there are 18 million vacant homes across the country. 10 million homeless, 18 million vacant homes. Public housing units have been demolished, and affordable housing has decreased by 60% since 2010. 30% of those who pay rent pay over half their income on housing, leaving little left for food and utilities. And there is no state in this nation where someone earning the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour can afford a two-bedroom apartment. That would take $21.10 an hour, three times. Housing is hardly affordable for most entering the housing market right now. In the last decade, corporate landlords such as Tryson Residential, Invitational Homes, and America Home for Rent have dominated the real estate market, buying up starter homes, easily outbidding individual buyers. They then hold these starter homes until they can sell them at much higher rates, or they rent them out for 30 to 40% of the previous rates, making housing unaffordable. Mobile home parks, which have traditionally provided more affordable housing, are facing similar threats when corporations are buying the entire tract and then increasing the cost of land rental by 100% or evicting residents as the land is sold for more profitable development. These problems with unaffordable housing impact everybody. The fact is that community welfare and stability require that a wide variety of income earners be present in each community. When housing costs rise too much, lower income residents are persuaded to leave or forced out. The smooth functioning of a town requires low wage and middle wage earners to coexist with high wage earners. If housing is not available, staffing shortages become problematic. We've seen this in restaurants and our hotels. The service businesses are understaffed, and law enforcement officers, firefighters, and healthcare providers can't live in the communities they serve. And traffic congestion becomes the big problem in wealthier communities as folks are forced to commute in from lower-costing towns. Providing affordable housing is a common good. And alongside the housing crisis is homelessness. Across the United States, it is estimated that between 2.5 and 3.5 million individuals live in shelters, transitional housing, or tent cities. On a single night, there's over 500,000 individuals sleeping on the streets. Seattle has the third highest homeless rate in the country, with a count of over 11,200 on the streets on a single night. And if we include those who are sleeping in their cars, in shelters, or transient shelters, there are 40,000 homeless in Seattle every night. 44% of people experiencing homelessness have a job but can't afford shelter. The majority of homeless families are headed by single women with children. And one quarter of these folk have disabilities, and one third have mental health diagnoses. In response to the fact that people are acting erratically in our streets, in response to concerns that people are cluttering the sidewalks and store entrances, and in response to piles of trash, unsanitary hygiene practices, and blatant drug use on the streets, cities have banned loitering and camping in public places. We have essentially made it criminal to be homeless. It is a moral witness to the state of this country that it allows this situation to continue. And we gather in moral witness to admit that our country has come to demonize and criminalize the acts of survival and the behaviors of the suffering, when we should instead respond with compassion and generosity. I am particularly thinking today of Jordan Neely, a mentally ill homeless man who was publicly strangled on the New York subway this past week when his erratic behavior became too much for one person. Jamel Bowie, a columnist for the New York Times, wrote these words: Our country is built to produce Jordan McNeelys, and it will continue to do so until we do something about the structure of the society in which we live. Our homelessness crisis, just like our crisis of poverty, is a policy choice. It is the foreseeable result of our thin and threadbare safety net and our refusal to turn the wealth of our society into a grant of decent housing, medical care, including psychiatric care, and safety for all. How did the wealthiest country in the world become complacent, oblivious to such a large amount of suffering? I experience shame when I hear the statistics, and I feel powerless, I feel discomfort, and I'm sure we all share that. I avert my attention from the housing dilemma, believing there is not much that I can do that will make a difference. So today I want to remind you of what we can do together that can make a difference, because it is going to take all of us working together, each of us sacrificing something to begin to address this. Social crises call for a variety of responses. We can educate each other about the crises and assess our response. Do we all know that on many nights of the week, we have people sleeping on the deck of our church and in the bushes around our building? How do we make sure we don't respond to that with anxiety, but rather with generosity to those at our doors? There's legislative action that we can take. Not only can we advocate to rescind laws that make being homeless a criminal, we can affirm fair housing policies, and we can penalize unfair housing profiteering by corporations. We can organize with others in response. I just heard from someone who purchased a housing unit and turned the management over to Attain Housing so that it will specifically be used for affordable housing. What if a group of us agreed to do that together, a community responding in witness to the need? And we can be together and witness. Our proudest activities in the last year have been when we showed up together at La Quinta in support of affordable housing in Kirkland. And when we came to witness Judy Jesielowski speak up at the city meeting in support of the La Quinta Housing Project. And we can provide direct service. We can expand our campus resources in order to provide services to those needing shelter. We have a house. We could make a difference to folk unable to afford living in Kirkland. If you are not aware of this, I feel it's important to let you know that over half the staff who work for this church are facing housing insecurity as we speak. The housing crisis isn't an abstract, distant one. It is here in this space affecting us all. Several months ago, a group of us started meeting to talk about how Northlake can be involved in the housing crisis. Fran Wesling, Mary Ellen Olison, and Peter Durham have worked with me to form the Just Housing team that's exploring a faith-based, action-oriented, compassionate response. Right now, we have focused our attention on how Hanley House can be restored to residential use and direct response to the Kirkland housing shortage. And we can take this further. We can explore and expand what we do if we have others join us with this vision, with their vision, time, and skills to add to our efforts. I truly believe in the power of communities of faith to make a difference. This work must be grounded in our religious work that renews our spirits, gives us hope, and sustains our souls. And we do this together because united, we are far more capable. I end these words with a poem from Marge Percy, The Low Road. In it, she says, "Alone, you can fight, you can refuse, you can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen, make a demonstration. 100, fill a hall. It goes on, one at a time. It starts when you care. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again, and they say no. It starts when you say we, and know that you mean each day you mean one more. Amen.